Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live from Chicago.
Working man in internet radio is my father, George Wilder Jr., and here he is.
Thank you for that, and welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being a part of the show. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening. Thank you for archiving. Thank you for, even marketing the show, and thanks for sharing the show with your friends. That's a great thing. That's wonderful for this show and for me and for everybody who's listening to the show. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. You can also contact me on Facebook. Contact me right here. Click like on Block Talk Radio. On my site, George Wilder Jr. Show. What am I doing? I sound like a commercial, right? But it's beautiful. It's a great day in Chicago. It's still a dull, dull day. It's still cold. And let's put it this way. Spring in Chicago and a lot of other places, especially those cities and states that have gotten mountains and mountains of snow, spring just seems to be on hold. I mean, I think in Chicago, it's been about 3 or 4 years that spring has been on hold. It seems like it's just jumped from a mild winter during the spring months to summer. And that's weird. That is real weird. And some people are saying it's climate change that's caused by humans. And something is going on. Something is not right in the atmosphere. Something is totally going wrong because it's freezing. We're freezing our asses off here in Chicago. And you know that the winters in Chicago are brutal. But this is spring, folks, and it's just spring is just not here. And for the rest of the week, they're saying that it's going to be more of the same. I'm in my studio. We're near the lake. It's a little cooler. It's always cooler near the lake, but it's colder out here now. And I'm in front of this great big old window, and I'm seeing people going here and there, from here and there. Some people are dressed for the weather. Some people are not. That's just the way it goes. But I can tell you this. When we go out, we dress for the weather. We do dress for the weather. And I think more people should dress for the weather because this type of weather, I mean, it's just type of weather that puts you under the weather. I mean, you get sick. I mean, the flu is still possible. I mean, after, even though winter is not here, the flu is still possible. With this weather being up and down and the way it changes so much, it messes with your body chemistry, and that can cause you to go into some sort of a sickness or illness. So I would suggest to people, when it's cold and freezing outside, put on some clothes. I mean, cover up your head. I see so many people, especially young ladies, even older women, out here in this freezing weather with nothing on their heads, you know, and you just know they're cold. They're pretending like they're not cold, but you can see they're turning red. So, you know, if they're turning red, the wind is really getting to them. So I would suggest to anybody who lives in this type of a climate, cold climates, dress warmly. Because if you get a sickness, and you, it's possible if you're going to work or school, you might take that sickness to work and affect everybody around you. And that's not good. So if you, even if you are sick, if you're sick and you don't feel good, stay home. Don't go to work. Don't go to school. You know, don't go to college or your universities, because you're going to affect other people. And a lot of those people at these institutions would prefer you stay at home when you are not feeling well because of the strangeness of the weather. Okay, that's enough about that. I probably will be saying a little bit more about that as the show progresses. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. I feel good. I feel great. It's been wonderful. I've been up basically booking shows, doing some writing, stuff like that, and preparing for the show tonight. I love preparing for the show. It's so simple, so easy that one person can do it. I want to say to some people who are saying, George, why don't you put your son on the radio? Why don't you interview him? I want to say this. I would love to have my son being by my side on this, or any of my supporters and fans. It doesn't matter. I would love to have my son by my side, but I have to acknowledge this is not his niche. This is not what he is good at. And I think he acknowledges it. It's not his niche. I can't force him to do something that is not in him. Don't get me wrong. He's a very talented guy. He's very smart. He's very bright. He will be 17. He's a very talented guy. He's very bright. But this is just not for him. I mean, I've tried it. I have had him on the show at least once or twice. I even had him to host the show. And we both kind of agree that it's not in his niche. And that's not saying something negative about him. It's just his talents lie elsewhere and not here. And I think I've made him understand, and I think he understands it. And so that is why if you go back and archive or listen to some of those shows, download some of the shows, you can find out for yourself, because there was one show, like I said, I had him hosting. He did a pretty good job, but I don't think that he or I thought he had done his best. And I hold nothing against him. I have no ill will against him because this is not his niche. He has no ill will against me because you know what he wants to be? He wants to be a comedian. And I mean, when I first heard it, I thought, what? A comedian? Then one day in the house, I said, stand up and tell a few jokes. And actually, he did. Excuse me. He did tell a few jokes, and they were kind of funny. They weren't all that, you know, fall down on the floor, belly laughing kind of jokes, but they would kind of make you smile. And sometimes when I take him to the doctor or to the dentist or somewhere out, and the people that he's talking to, the people that's around him, he's always saying something. He says something that's funny, and everybody's laughing. And I'm looking, wow, maybe he is funny. Maybe, you know, but that could be what his niche is. That could be what he should be doing. But I think the field is so crowded, he'd probably have trouble making money at doing that. But I'm not going to put him down if that's what he wants to do. That's what he wants to do. He's also good at a lot of other things, you know. He's a very smart guy. I think he'd be good at anything he wants to do. Anything he wants to do, I think he'd be good at it. But I do not think he has a niche for being a radio host. But who knows? Maybe if, you know, maybe it'll just take him longer to learn the system or to learn what it takes to be a radio host. And then again, I'm thinking that this is not his niche, because he doesn't seem as though he's really ambitious about it. Not this particular career. that he would like to go into. But I'm fine. I'm fine. It's fine. He's talented in other areas, and this is not his niche. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio 609. This is WTTY on Block Talk Radio, and it's a great day. I mean, I feel good. Everything's going on greatly. My guest is author Richard Franklin, and it's just a wonderful day, and I love it, and I love it, I love it, I love it, I love it. Even though it's gray, it's nasty, it's cold, but I'm on the inside, and that's great. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. I will be right back. Stay with me, everybody. You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. Welcome back to the George Wilder Jr. Show. You can always find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, Blog Talk Radio. I'm right here at Google. I'm all over the place. You can even find me on other folks' websites, and that's great. I'm even on YouTube. A lot of people who are on the show, they download the show. A lot of the guests that are on the show, they download the show and upload it and sometimes put it on YouTube. That's fine with me. That's fine with me because it's all about them. It's not me. They're here to tell you and me what they're about and then put it out there to the world. All right, let's move right along. I'm looking at this headline on my screen, and I can hardly believe what it's saying. Okay, the Wynn Resorts, W-Y-N-N, Wynn Resorts, that's I'm thinking that's a hotel chain, but I will read the article later to make sure. But the Wynn Resort sounds to me like a hotel chain, and it says here the Wynn Resort's founder, and I'm quoting the founder of these resorts. He's saying right here, he's saying nobody likes being around poor people. I mean, when I was just cruising the internet, cruising this website, and all of a sudden I came up on this headline that just slapped me in the face. And I'm going to read it again. It says, nobody likes being around poor people. You know what? I guess this says it all. This tells us what these people are. Racism, you know, is just astounding. This Wynn, I just can't get over it. This Wynn Resort's founder says nobody likes being around poor people. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show, 347-857-1762. Call in with your comment or just sit back and just relax and just listen to the show because I am astounded by this. Nobody likes being around poor people. You know, I think there's some people out there, but I'm not going to justify that comment because I think it's stupid, it's silly, it's uncalled for. I believe even the writer of this article thought it was just awful for someone to say something like this. But I'm pretty sure that's what a lot of people around this country, in this country, thinks. But a lot of these nuts that come out and say things like this, nobody likes being around poor people, they're just saying something that a lot of people have inside of them that they refuse to say or can't say or will not say. But this guy, this is just crazy. He says he doesn't like being around poor people. It a day doesn't go by unless somebody says something dumb and stupid, and they get a lot of press for it. They get a lot of space for it. You know, so this is probably going to get 1,000 or more hits on YouTube or something. Nobody likes being around poor people. Let me go. Okay, the article is written. It was 4 hours ago. This is very recent, all right? It's written by Robert Frank. And the guy, his name is Steve Wynn. Okay, I've never heard of him, but obviously he has these resorts. He's a rich guy, probably. More than likely, he's a rich guy because I'm assuming he owns a lot of these resorts. In a presentation to investors, Wednesday night, Wynn, the founder of Wynn Resorts, said his company is like a luxurious. His company is like a luxury brand that focuses on people with money. He explained that the environment that attracts and caters to the wealthy will attract everyone else. Okay, here is a quote by this guy, and I quote, "Rich people only like being around rich people," he said. "Nobody likes being around poor people, especially," he's saying it, "especially poor people." Okay, he says, "Rich people only like being around rich people." He said, "Nobody likes being around poor people, especially poor people." He said that. He said poor people twice in his one-line quote. Man, this is something. He's going to get a lot of flack for this. I mean, there's a lot of rich people out here who were once poor themselves. And it doesn't bother them to be around poor people. That is just one stupid statement. And this guy himself is rich and he owns all these resorts. So he's going to say what he's going to say and he's still going to be rich, even if it's dumb and stupid. And in some parts, I don't think what he's saying is actually true. Nobody likes being around poor people, especially poor people. He's saying poor people twice in one quote. It's obviously that he doesn't like being around poor people. That's what he should say. He should probably not generalize about rich people if they want to be around poor people or not. Just say he, Steve Wynn, doesn't want to be around poor people. That would have made more sense than to generalize. Because like I just said, a lot of people, a lot of rich people were once poor themselves and pulled themselves up by their bootstraps to get where they are. And some rich people who were once poor never forgot where they had started from. So this guy is totally wrong in his thinking, but that's, you know, what they do. This tells you right then that they have no clue what poor people go through, that are going through. But this is an erroneous statement. This is crazy. And this is just a, maybe he just said this to get attention. Well, then you know what? He surely got my attention, because I never heard of him, you know, but there's a lot of people I haven't heard of who are doing well in this country. But this is crazy. I mean, what the hell? One of my Facebook friends said to me, he said, George, this country has gone completely, completely crazy. And I totally had to agree with him. I mean, people say some of the dumbest, the stupidest things to get attention, and they get it. And this is something people should be talking about, but nobody's talking about this but me. Nobody's talking about this specific quote but me. And maybe it'll catch on, because this is totally this is totally outrageous. All right, this line is sure to go viral. That's what I just said. It's going to go viral on YouTube. It's going to go viral. I'm the only one talking about it now. But I'm pretty sure as time goes on and the media catches on to this, they are going to eat this up. This line is sure to go viral as the latest tone-deaf billionaire, akin to 2014 remarks made by technology venture capitalist Tom Perkins, saying that rich people are being persecuted and should get more votes. In fairness to Wynn, Steve Wynn, the guy who made that quote, the incendiary line does not represent the full context text of his remark. They're saying that now people who read that statement that rich people should not be, don't like to be around poor people, they're saying that we're taking his words out of context, that he didn't say it like that. But what the hell? It came out of his mouth. Does not represent the full context of his remarks. So there's more that he's saying. Maybe he's clarifying what he's saying as he makes his remarks. But this clearly came out of his mouth. And the media is going to go after the most viral ass quote there is. Now they're calling it a graph, a mistake, something he shouldn't have said, and that we've taken his words out of context. You know, I don't know what to think, but this is really, really bad. Okay, he began by saying how Wynn Resorts is a luxury brand like Louis Vuitton than a casino or a hotel chain. This company, okay, I'm quoting him, this company caters to the top end of the gaming world, he said. We are sort of a Chanel or Louis Vuitton, to use the comparison, the metaphor of the retail business. But unlike Chanel and Louis, these are brands able in our business to cater to all of the market by making our standards high that everybody wants to be in the building. I'm kind of confused on trying to understand that, but he said what he said. Okay, the guy said what he said, and you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. I will be right back. Stay with me, folks. We'll be right back. All right, he's backing off of his statement. He's backing off of that quote, and that says nobody likes being around poor people. He's sort of backing off of it. As I read the entire context of the message, he's kind of backing off of it, but it is still bad. It is still bad. And I'm pretty sure he's going to have to do a lot more explaining than that. Nobody likes being around poor people. Like I said before, folks, this guy, Steve Wynn, the owner of all of these resorts, should have not generalized. Maybe he should have just talked about himself, because like I just got through saying, a lot of people who are rich were once poor themselves, and they've never forgotten where they came from. Apparently, Steve Wynn has. Wow. I mean, this is enough to open your eyes, man. This is enough to open your eyes, you know. You know, I guess you just have to be a people person to be around people. If you are a people person, it doesn't matter how much money you have. You love being around people. You're going to be around people. I would not be doing this show, this talk show, if I didn't like being around people, if I didn't like talking to people, if I wasn't a people person, I would not be doing this show. You know, but there are some people out here who are fakers, pretending like they love being around other people, pretending like they are people oriented, and they're not, but they're just doing it because what? For monetary reasons or value or whatever. But in a business, I just got through talking about my son and how this is not his niche, but he's a beautiful kid, but this is not his niche. You have to be people oriented. In other words, you have to be a people person in order to work and deal with people. I mean, I've worked with a lot of people at some of my jobs I've had throughout my life. I've worked with a lot of people who were not people oriented. They were not people persons, if that's a way to describe it. They were not, but they worked around people. I can always tell people who are not people oriented, even if they try to fake it, that they are. You know, they're out there. I mean, some people who are not people oriented, they will tell you in a minute, I don't like people. I can't stand being around people. I don't want to be on your show. I don't want to be talking to them people. I don't want to be on your show, George, because I don't want to talk to you. I get nervous. I'm not a people person. I've had people say that. And I just say, all right, you know, because I don't want anybody on my show that's not people oriented, because we may, you know, get into some sort of verbal conflict, and I don't want that, you know. But you have to be a people person to get. I think you have to be a people person in order to get along with people around you. And I can't understand why there are so many people in the work who are not people oriented. They don't like people, and most employees can, you know, eat that out. Find out, you know, that's simple. Because if someone is in your workplace doesn't like people, they're going to always want to be alone. And if they, you know, they may fake it and say, hey, let's go out to have coffee or something. And, you know, they may not talk much or whatever. But anyway, you have to be a people person. And this guy who said, this founder who said this, nobody likes being around poor people, obviously he's not a people person, or he just wants to be around people who with plenty of cash. Maybe that's the kind of people he have at his resorts, are rich people, and he they get around, they talk, and they talk about how they hate and can't stand people with no money. How they hate and can't stand people working people. You know, it's people like that out there. And that's one of the things people have to realize. Just because you're going to work every day, you got a car, you're paying your house note, there's somebody out there calling you, you know, a loser. Somebody's calling you a loser because you are not rich like they are. You have to go somewhere and bust your ass to come back to pay your bills. You know, so that's what happens. So there's a lot of people out there who aren't people persons. They're not people oriented. And for this guy, I'm going to say this again. I'm going to repeat this again. This guy, Steve Wynn, he owns resorts, I'm assuming around the country. And he put out a quote that's probably going to go totally viral on YouTube, the internet, wherever it is. This guy is saying, and I quote, he's saying, nobody likes to be around poor people. And when I first saw that headline, I just flipped. I said, what is this? This can't be true. This has to be a misprint, but it's not. And now I think he's trying to take it back. I think he's trying to walk that back by saying that we've taken his words out of context. But how can you take anything out of context that's verbatim? It's verbatim. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder. This is going to haunt me for the rest of this show. It's probably going to haunt me for the rest of my future shows. I mean, this guy is saying nobody likes being around poor people. And I'm going to say this again. Some poor people, some rich people, millionaires, billionaires, some of them, not all of them, some of them used to be poor. And some of them has never forgotten where they came from. I mean, this guy is totally out of touch. It's unreal. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm broadcasting live out of Chicago. It's beautiful, but it's dull. It's gray and it's cold. I'm here in my studio looking out on the boulevard. People got on heavy coats. They're wearing heavy coats in springtime. Go figure. Go figure. All right, let's go to the phone to see who we got here. All right, you're on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
Oh,
you're on.
George, hi, George. This is Dick Franklin in beautiful Durango, 72 degrees, and not cold like you have. And I'm the one who was writing. Yeah, beautiful. Hey, and I was writing to you a little earlier about a blog series that I had written about 3 years ago called Writing from Behind the Curve. I don't know if you remember that, but essentially, it was written to encourage people who have had, the idea of a novel in their head, something that they've wanted to write for the last, 20, 30, 40 years in some cases, to actually write that novel. So it was to encourage that, but it was also to look at the impediments. Why haven't people written those novels? And they're 75 years old today, and they still haven't written them. And so that's what I was calling in about, is to see if we could just kick that around a little bit tonight. And see if perhaps that would be interesting to your audience. I know that you try to add value to your audience's experience when they're listening to you. So that's part of what I'm trying to do.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is author Richard Franklin on the George Wilder Jr. Show. And let me see if I can dig out some of your autobiography. Okay. All right. This is author Richard Franklin on the George Wilder Jr. Show. All right. Tell us something about yourself. Bio.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me tell you that I am I'm a senior citizen today. I started writing when I was in my 40s. That's part of what I'll be talking about with you, I hope. But
yes.
I was a banker, George, for 20-some years with a large international bank. And so I was the area manager for San Diego for that bank, and I headed up private banking in North America for that bank. And so I had an experience of and what brought me to writing From Behind the Curve, which is an eight part blog series, by the way.
Okay.
Was a realization that like me, so many others. Unless you were schooled and educated to become a writer right out of the chute, you're 20 years old and you start writing. If you were someone else, you were schooled and educated maybe to be a banker like me or to be something else, or you were very busy raising a family, or you do a lot of things for the community. Anyway, so certainly in that first quite a few numbers of years, and I'd like to say for like the first 45 years, you may have been fully committed, and even though you had this idea that you always wanted to write a book, you didn't write that book because of that. But, you know, maybe you've run across a statistic like this. Kind of interesting that 80% of the adult population has said that they would like to write a novel at some time in their lives. But you know what percentage actually do? 2%. So you have this enormous disparity, 78% disparity. And so what I was trying to do with writing behind the curve, well, for a number of reasons. And so that's what Writing Behind the Curve is trying to do. So let me just give you a couple of examples of what I think are impediments. And why is somebody at, you know, if you say to someone, and we've all heard people say, I'd like to write a novel. And then you'll say, well, why haven't you? And when they, when you say that to them, many times they say, well, you know, no one would really read me, and I don't think I could get it published. And what I would like to suggest to your audience is if they have an idea, something that they would like to write, and they've had it for a long time, it's the wrong orientation to think, you know, you're 55 years old, let's say, and it's the wrong orientation to think about, oh, I have to write to be published. I think the orientation, the referencing should be, I'm writing to finally complete a lifelong dream to write. I'm writing first and foremost for myself, and not for a friend, not for family, not for notoriety, and certainly not for a publisher. I'm writing to know that I have accomplished the act of writing, something that I've been thinking about for a very, very long time. And I think if you say that to yourself, you immediately take away the pressure of trying to figure out, how am I going to write at a level that is going to be publishable? Now, maybe you're the Grandma Moses of writing. You know, maybe you're going to, you know, she didn't start painting in earnest until she was 78. And so maybe you're the Grandma Moses of writing, and you're just going to, maybe you have that latent talent that is going to be so superior that it'll be acknowledged. But you're not going to put that burden on yourself to begin with. And, you know, everybody talks about being published, you know, when you think about writers and being published. And yet, you know, we all know, you know, if you say Agatha Christie or John Grisham or Stephen King or James Patterson. We know all those names, right? But the average published writer sells 250 copies of their published novel a year. And the average is 3,000 total copies over the published lifetime of that novel. So even though we want to be published, it's sort of like the NBA. You know, you have millions of people playing basketball, but only a few of them get to be playing at that level that everybody knows who they are. They're paid accordingly, right? You know.
Right.
The other thing.
Richard, what about self-publishing? Yep.
Self-publishing? I mean, I've done that myself, George. I wrote. I think I mentioned I started writing in my 40s, and
yeah, I got it
my
right
first
here.
Novel. Yeah, my first novel, Lake Clarity Is Dying, is a self-published novel on Amazon, and I think that's a way for people to go. There's 3 million books on Amazon, roughly, and if someone, people have to decide for themselves at what level do they want to write, right? In other words, you can write for yourself at any level. You can write for maybe yourself and your family, a few of your friends, a close little circle. And you can write at the level that you're at today, or you can decide, you know, I want to be as good as I can be, and then you can start doing some other things. And you can lead to an e-book, maybe to a published book from a publishing house. But certainly the e-book, as I say, there's 3 million of them, hard to distinguish yourself in a 3 million book environment.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. How do you distinguish yourself, all of these ebooks up there, and some writers, they don't like to think of other ebook publishers, other ebook writers, as competition. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I don't know how they determine. The only way you could determine competition, I think, George, would be on the basis of volumes and all of that sort of thing. But, I think the uniqueness of your own writing style, the uniqueness of your story is what distinguishes you competitively. And you either have
exactly.
that or you don't.
I agree totally.
You know. Yeah, so you either have that or you don't. Now the idea of writing behind the curve, though, on the other hand, is to not suggest that you have to even do that. You don't have to go for an ebook. You don't have to try to be published. You can the sheer fact that you are writing what you have wanted to write for all of these years is ample reward, and you actually have some. And you know, we have a digital we're in a digital world today. So think about somebody writes something, and they write it, and it goes into the ether. It goes into the cloud. 50 or 100 years from now, 500 years from now, maybe, but certainly their great 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 grandchild can look back into their mind and know what that person thought was important in 2016, and what a legacy that you can create if you think of it in terms of writing within a family. I volunteer at a medical center / nursing home, and I've done that for a number of years. Well, one of the ladies there, her name is Hildy, and she's 78 years old. I met her a few years ago, and I saw that she was a voracious reader. I mean, she just has two or three books going all the time. And I said, Hildy, have you ever thought of writing?
Exactly.
A good writer often is a very good reader, right? They've read a lot of stuff. And so she said, I kind of thought about it. I've got it. And so I with a little bit of encouragement, well, next thing I know, she and about six other ladies in this rest home, ranging in age from about 70 to 92.
70
to 92. They start a writer's club. They start a writer's club.
That's great.
Isn't that great? So the director of activity every week would give them a topic for them to write.
Yeah.
And the next week they come and they read their stories to each other. And so she got to where she got so confident of her writing. So one day she said, well, you know, I'm going to submit some of my stories to the county fair because they do an evaluation at the county fair. So she sends it. So I never get a call. I see her every week, but we don't call each other. And so all of a sudden, one morning about 8 a.m., I get this call, a very excited Hildy. She said, I just heard from the county. I've got two blue ribbons and one honorable mention for writing the first thing she ever wrote in her life. How about that?
Wow.
She says there's a lot of latent talent out there.
And I want to say to her. I want to say to her, congratulations. That's great.
I was so thrilled for her. And another lady there by the name of Mary Ann, who's not with us anymore, but Mary Ann spent the last 2 years of her life writing a memoir, really the history of her family that she wanted to share with her. She only had one grandchild, a grandson, and she wrote this through everything for a two-year period, and that was given to him at her memorial. Now, talk about a legacy where you have actually written that over a two-year period for your grandson. So these opportunities to write, and a lot of, but if you can write at 78 years of age in a nursing home, imagine what you can do in a normal walk of life situation. And that's that's what we're trying to do.
And you've got some of that experience at this nursing home volunteering. You got some ideas from that for your book, Writing Behind the Curve.
Yeah, I did, and I really believe that whether it's characters, we've met, by the time you're 40, 50, 60 years of age, have you not met every personality on the planet? Have you not met, the angry and the happy and, the foolhardy? And have you not met every physical characteristic that exists in a human being and so on? And I think you draw from your experiences. And for example, I once volunteered at a hospice. Well, my second novel, Teddy Little Bear, is actually the evolution of a fellow that gets drawn into that environment of a hospice and how it changes him from being a pretty myopic, nasty character, and how it changes him over the evolution of a book. But having volunteered as a hospice volunteer, I already had a sense of that environment. Likewise, you know, Lake Clarity Is Dying, my first novel, is written about the 50-year fight over the oldest lake in North America. I call it Lake Clarity in my book, but it's actually Mono Lake in the eastern Sierra Nevada. Well, I've lived in that area before. So what I'm getting at is you can start from scratch, and certainly a sci-fi author has to do that, right? They have to build everything. But in many cases, I think you have some experiences or some knowledge that help you to actually start writing your own novel. And a lot of people out there who listen to you have experience. Matter of fact, the novels that they've thought about writing come from their background, come from their youth, or come from some other time. Do you find that for yourself? I know you've written 15 or so novels.
Yeah, you have to write what you know. You know, from your experience, a lot of the things I write, even if I write fiction, I'm always incorporating something into that novel or that story, something about that has taken place in my life, you know,
yeah,
or
exactly.
in someone else's life that I've known. And because it's true, you have to write what you know. And also, like you're saying in your book, basically one of the things you're saying is, enjoy what you're doing, you know.
Absolutely.
If you like writing, if you love it, then to be a good writer, you not only you have to read the good books, the classics, but you have to enjoy what you're doing. You know, that's why I write. I write because it's fun. It is fun.
Oh yeah.
If it wasn't fun. And I love it.
Yeah.
And it's, for me, it's like a stress reducer. You know?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right.
Go right
ahead. I'm in the process of writing a third novel right now, and I won't go into any detail about it, except to say that what makes it unique for me is that it is about a 17th century Europe, and so when you have to want to write something like that, because it takes an enormous amount of additional labor in that case, because of all of the research you're going to do, that you don't necessarily have to do for something that is more common to you. But when you go into a period book, different time in history, and certainly in a different continent. Now, I've been to Europe, but that doesn't mean I've lived in the 16 and 17.
Well, yeah, you've
right?
been there, and, so you
yeah.
you've been there,
yeah.
and you've experienced some things there, so you feel that you can probably mold a story around it.
Yeah, well, that's my plan. You know, another thing. Mm-hmm. In speaking of impediments that people have, you know, one of the big issues is time. In other words, finding the time to write in a busy life that people have. And I already talked about how early on in your life, you know, you've got a full plate. You may have a very busy, and you're just getting to that novel when you're 28 years old in the midst of your career, and all, it's very hard to do unless you started out to be a writer. But let's say, you know, how many times have you or I read from the writing community, they'll say, write, if you're going to be a writer, you must write every day. Write.
Yeah,
write,
I've heard
every
that.
Day.
Many
times. And so, but I would say this for people, let's say you're 45 years old, you now have your children in college, or they're gone from the house, and you have some discretionary time. That admonition to write every day is not only unhelpful, I think it's counterproductive. In other words, if you can't meet that kind of frequency because of your other commitments, what happens to people who can't meet a frequency? They shelve an idea. I can't meet that criteria. I'd much rather have someone think in terms of, well, you know what, I can write 3 or 4 times a week, or I can write 8 times a month, and then stick to that schedule. In other words, if you make that commitment because that works with your busy lifestyle, then stick to that commitment, and you will actually finish your novel then. You'll actually get it done. And so the time You know, there's things like that. There's things like writer's block would be another one. You know, I've heard people say, well, you know, everybody says they have writer's block. And I said, you know, my first book was a 500-page book, and I have to tell you honestly, I never had writer's block once. And I said,
yeah.
Why is that? And I said, because maybe I was already well into my 40s when I started writing the first draft of that. And I wrote five full drafts,
yeah.
From A to
yeah.
Z. But
some people have writer's block, and I've had people on the show that were authors, are authors, and some say they have writer's block. Some say they do not have writer's block. But there's times when I get
yeah.
it. But
do you?
You know. Yeah, I get it sometimes, but not for long. I mean, I can sit staring
you
at a blinking.
You go out for a ham sandwich? What do? You go out for a ham sandwich or run around the track? What do you do?
You know what I do? You know what I do when I get writer's block? I get up and go walking around the neighborhood.
Do you? Yeah. See, that's.
I go walking around the neighborhood.
You read all these therapies.
Yeah, I go walking around the neighborhood, and ideas start coming to me. You know.
Yeah.
And.
Right.
And the ideas will start coming to me, and then I'll, you know, just, well, actually, it's just exercise. I exercise, and then the ideas will just come to me, and I'll come back, and I sit at the laptop, and the ideas just flow on paper, you know?
Yeah.
But I get writer's block every now and then. It's not an impediment. It doesn't hold me back, because I think writer's block is a part of the writer's block for me is a part of the process, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, the only thing, I know you got other things to do tonight, but the only last thing I would mention here,
mm-hmm.
I certainly would like to give people an opportunity to access at no charge, of course, the blog and read the eight series blog. But the other thing is, you know, some people have been thinking about writing for a very long time, and they actually have 2, 3, 4 stories in mind. And one of the issues is, okay, well, what do I start with? And I would just suggest to any of your audience out there that really is in that position and are going to start to write that novel that they've been thinking about, one of the 3 or 4, to write one that is, I'll call it the simplest in construction first. And by that,
yes.
I mean, you know, I know when I wrote Lake Clarity is Dying, well, that had about 10, it has 10 characters that I would call key characters. It's a 500-page book with about 7 or 8 subplots, and it covers a 50-year period, so there's a number of retrospectives that go through that 50 years. So, you know, if I was going to do it over, I would not write that kind of a book as my very first. It is one reason why I wrote it 5 times, all the way through
mm-hmm.
5 times. And
mm-hmm.
and it would be to start with a book that you say, I can start today. It kind of goes forward from here.
Mm-hmm.
And it
mm-hmm.
maybe doesn't has 3 or 4 characters that are important to the story, not 10. And that it doesn't do a bunch of retrospectives. It just stays, and it's a nice, clean story. And get your sea legs with that story. And then if there's a more complicated story in mind that you have, work on that story subsequently.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, take the, you know, it's a learning curve. I know that when I was writing my first story, I was
mm-hmm.
reading about writing as I was writing it. And so I would read a lot about writing, and I would
yeah.
write. And I'd get to
yeah.
the end of the story and say, you know, I've learned enough that I need to rewrite this story again. And I would write it again. And so, but I think that would be a suggestion that I would have is to just try to stay. And that doesn't mean that's a simple idea. It just simply
yeah.
means the construction of the story is more basic and allows you to concentrate on plot and character development and not the mechanisms that go with the actual story itself. So anyway, may I tell you how your audience may access my blog, this blog?
Oh yeah, we're going
so
to get to all of that. I just
want
to, we're going to
okay.
get to all of that. I just want to say, you've offered some great advice. I mean, this, even I'm learning, okay? You've offered some great advice. You've been a great guest. You've been wonderful. And
I hope
the audience out there, whether they, you know, I mean, this show is archived. This show is saved. This show is recorded. And there's always
right.
a link to this show. So Once this show is over, would you like a link sent to you so you can maybe put it up on your blog? Yeah, no problem. I can do that.
Sure.
I can do that. Now you,
that'd be very nice.
Now you
thank you.
Okay. You can now tell the audience where they can find all your material, your books, and stuff like that, and website and blog.
Okay. Well, here's the easiest way, I believe, would be to just go to Amazon.com. And, you know, there's a search field once you get into that site. And then just put, you know, I have a pen name. My pen name is R. Scott Franklin. So put R, letter R, space, Scott, S-C-O-T-T, and then a space, and then Franklin, F-R-A-N-K-L-I-N. And once you do that, then hit that button, then you would automatically, you're going to see some books pop up, and two of those books are mine. One of them is called Lake Clarity is Dying, and the other one is called Teddy Little Bear. If you click on my author name in either one of those covers, it will take you to my profile page. I'm afraid you're going to have to look at my picture. But anyway, you go to my
I'm pretty sure it's a great-looking picture. It's a great-looking picture.
You go to my profile page, and then right in that profile area, all eight of those blogs show up right in a horizontal row. And please, for your audience, go in, click on them, read them, print them, do whatever you would like. But I do hope you would look at all 1 through 8, because I believe there's a lot of things, of course, we just don't have time to cover tonight.
Okay,
that would be nice to do. And then if you want to write me a note, just write me a note down below. You know, you may want to know, for example, I said I was using a number of references while I was writing and rewriting. I'll be happy to share those with anyone who would like to improve their technical skill. You know, what did I use to help to improve my technical skill? What kinds of things was I doing at that time to write a 500-page novel? I'll be happy to share that
or kick around
any other aspect that they might be interested in doing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Even I'm gonna go to your Amazon page and find out a lot of things about you. And like I said, thanks for being on the show. And I'm gonna get that link out to you in about in about 2 hours.
Okay.
Thanks for being on the show.
Very nice. Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you, George. Bye bye.
Bye bye. All right, that was Richard Franklin listeners and fans a taste of his knowledge on writing. That's great. That's wonderful. I will be right back. Stay with me, everybody. Let's see if we can find I will be right back. Thank you.
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio.
The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air.
Once again, I want to thank my guests, my wonderful guests, my most knowledgeable guest on writing, Rich Franklin. And I hope you guys who listened to this show, you know, go check out his books, go check out everything. He's out there to help. He's out there to help just like everybody else is trying to help people who want to write. And he's right. He is totally right. You don't have to worry about being published. You don't have just write because you want to do it. You love doing it. You have stories to tell. You have stories inside of you to tell and tell them. You know, it feels great. It feels great. It's wonderful. And I want to thank him again for being on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Okay, I'm looking at something on the website here. And it's Karen Lewis. She's the president of the CTU, the Teachers Union in Chicago. And she gets an automatic third term without even having any election. Well, that's the union. That's what these people can do. I'm not all for this union because this union is all about itself and not the children. They're, well, we are for the kids. Okay. This union is not for the children. This union is about the union here. I'm not on the bandwagon of busting unions, but there are some bad unions out here. There are some greedy unions out here. There are some unions that do not give a damn about the children. They'll claim that they care, but they truly don't. And you can tell that by their actions. And Chicago Public Schools are some of the worst schools in the United States. And I'm going to say that I'm in Chicago. They are. I mean, sometimes I think it's better off if some parents, if they have the knowledge and the education to teach them kids, to homeschool their children, is what I'm trying to say. Homeschool your kids. It's better than, having to lug them to some school where they're not learning much. Only thing they're learning is is how to strike and some other things that they should not be learning. Okay, I don't think that these people are good for our children. I really don't, because the teachers in Chicago, from my understanding, are some of the highest paid teachers in America, and they're out here striking for more money to line their pockets. They're out here striking for more taxpayer money, and I don't want to give them another dime of. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't want to be actually paying no teacher's pension. Nobody's pension. Nobody's paying mine. Why should I pay theirs? For retirement, that's up to the city to try to find that money elsewhere. You're not digging in our pockets. Okay, Karen Lewis. Okay, let's see who's the article written by. Chicago's teachers union delegates vote Wednesday night to cancel upcoming elections after no one stepped forward to challenge President Karen Lewis, who automatically keeps her office for a third term. Wow. Okay, all right. So nobody stepped up, okay? The move was billed as a money saver. Okay, they're saving money. All right. A CTU spokesman, Stephanie Gratlin, said to spare members the $300,000 cost of elections in May that would merely have confirmed existing union leaders. Well, the Chicago Public Schools don't have money, so obviously this is why they just did this. She didn't have an opponent. Maybe that's within union guidelines. I don't know. The idea was floated at Wednesday night's meeting of the House of Delegates. Who in the hell is the House of Delegates? that I guess I could find out if I really cared, but it doesn't make sense. House of Delegates, like these people are, above God or something. I don't know. And then approved after no challengers appeared. Okay, so basically they're saying they voted her in because she had no challengers. Okay. I like I said before, I don't know anything about the workings of the union and the House of Delegates. I'm not a part of it, and I'm glad to say that I'm not a part of it, because Chicago Public Schools are in total disarray. And if my son wasn't being was not going to be a sophomore this year, I probably would keep him home and teach him myself. But one of the reasons why I sent my son to public schools, these schools out here, was because, not because I did not want to keep him home and homeschool him. It was that I wanted him to be out among other people his age, other teenagers, other children, to do the things that they do. I didn't want to keep him smothered around me all the time or around his mother all the time. I just wanted him to go out and be in the world, kind of. I just wanted him to be around his peers. And I think that's good for him. He's not the only person that's thinking that, okay? But I wanted him to be out there, and I still do. I still do. I think he's a kid. I think he should be out there in the world. But a lot of times, like many parents, I'm worried about my son when he's out there. I mean, this is Chicago. Give me a break. What can I say? All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. Like I said before, yesterday's show, I'm going to be doing some more on diabetes. It's probably going to be a short segment on diabetes I'm going to try and do before the show is over. If I do not do it, I surely will get back to it on Monday. This is Thursday. April 7th. I will be back on the 11th. So give me some time to, because like Mr. Franklin said, you know, we're all busy. I'm extra busy. I have a lot of things to do. I have a lot of things to catch up on. I'll be back on Monday. I do the show 4 days a week. Going from 6 o'clock, starting at 6 o'clock, 6 o'clock to 7:30, sometimes 8 o'clock, from Monday through Thursday. Monday through Thursday. My time is always getting tied. Monday through Thursday. And I want to thank my guest for being on the show. I want to thank the guests that I booked earlier in the week. Some did not show up. And that's okay. Things happen. Things happen. I understand. I truly do understand. And we're in Chicago, folks, and I'm going to move right along. We still do not have a budget in Chicago. I mean, we are in our 10th month without a budget. From my understanding, Rahm Emanuel, Mayor of Chicago, sent a bill, sent something to Governor Bruce Rauner on supporting police pensions or something, and Rauner clearly said he's not going to do it. He's not going to sign anything into law, any kind of fund into law for any agency, no matter how bad they need it, no matter how bad they need it and how much is available, especially when it is available. He just won't give it. He just will not give it. It's not affecting his pocket. He's going to always be a billionaire, but he just don't like working people. He doesn't like poor people. He doesn't like people who are in colleges and universities. I mean, he's a Republican. What can you say? There's still no budget. No budget means there's no spending. If there is spending in Illinois, it is court ordered. There would be no spending here in the state of Illinois paying for anything if it wasn't for the court. The money that's being paid out in Illinois right now is money that they don't have. And every day we go without a budget, the further and further and further Illinois is in debt. They got to find a way to pay these bills. They got to find a way to pay the bills that they are supposed to pay. This is in the Illinois Constitution. If you're not paying these bills, you don't have a budget, you're not doing your job. You're breaking the laws of the Illinois Constitution. I wish Obama would come out and say something about this stalemate. I wish he'd come out and say something, but he'll probably say, well, I said something already. I don't need to say anything more. I wish he'd come out a little bit more forceful. After all, Chicago is his hometown. I mean, you don't want to see your hometown be destroyed by some overzealous Republican governor. And I just don't understand it. I really don't understand it. All right, we're going to do a little bit more on diabetes, because the diabetes epidemic is real, people. It is real. And everybody who's overweight does not have diabetes. Even those who are seem as if they're in their natural weight, 130 pounds. I mean, you have kids, children with diabetes. So don't always think of diabetes as someone being 200, 300, 400 pounds. Think of diabetes as just being a dangerous disease that's affecting a hell of a lot of people. I mean, I'm in my studio right here, and I've got this big mirror window in front of me, and I'm looking out, and I'm saying how many people are passing by my window who has diabetes or who do not know that they have diabetes. They could be pre-diabetic. It's phenomenal. And everybody's got these different ways of trying to combat diabetes. Diabetes, from my understanding, is curable. You can cure it. You can cure it through fasting. You can cure it through exercising, eating right. And in some cases, just exercising, you can cure it through. Because when you're exercising, what you're doing? You're burning calories. And every time you burn calories, reduces can reduce your insulin taking or pricking of your fingers or whatever you do when you have diabetes, you know. So it's a mess, and it's a worldwide epidemic. It's just not in the United States. This is all over the world, and somehow they're saying that we've lost a fight in trying to combat diabetes. And it is totally curable. But so many people have succumbed to diabetes that I think could have went on to lead, you know, better lives, greater lives, if they'd have just adhered to the treatments of that disease. All right, you're listening to George Wilder Jr. on the George Wilder Jr. Show. We will be right back with this short clip.
I have the best job in the world. I'm a doctor. No, believe me. That's not why. I'm an obesity doctor. I have the honor of working with a group of people subject to the last widely accepted prejudice, being fat. These people have suffered a lot by the time they see me. Shame, guilt, blame, and outright discrimination. The attitude that many take, including those in healthcare, is that these people are to blame for their situation. If they could just control themselves, they wouldn't be overweight. And they're not motivated to change. Please let me tell you, this is not the case. The blame, if we've got to extend some here, has been with our advice, and it's time we change that. Obesity is a disease. It's not something created by lack of character. It's a hormonal disease, and there are many hormones involved, and one of the main ones is a hormone called insulin. Most obese individuals are resistant to this hormone, insulin. So what does that mean exactly, to be resistant to insulin? Well, insulin resistance is essentially a state of type 2 diabetes. Insulin's job is to drive glucose or blood sugar into the cells where it can be used. In a nutshell, when someone is insulin resistant, they are having trouble getting blood sugar where it needs to go into those cells. And it just can't hang out in the blood after we eat, or we would all have a diabetic crisis after every meal. So when someone is resistant to insulin, the body's response to this is to just make more of it. And insulin levels will rise and rise, and for a while, years even, this is going to keep up, and blood sugar levels can remain normal. However, usually it can't keep up forever. And even at those elevated levels of insulin are not enough to keep blood sugar in the normal range. So it starts to rise. That's diabetes. It probably won't surprise you to hear that most of my patients have insulin resistance or diabetes. And if you're sitting there thinking, "Phew, that's not me," you actually might want to think again. Because almost 50% of adult Americans now have diabetes or prediabetes. That is almost 120 million of us. But that's hardly everyone who has issues with insulin. Because as I was saying, people have elevated insulin levels due to insulin resistance for years, even decades before the diagnosis of even prediabetes is made. Plus, it's been shown that 16 to 25% of normal weight adults are also insulin resistant. So in case you're keeping track, this is a heck of a lot of us. So the trouble with insulin resistance is if it goes up, we are at great risk for developing type 2 diabetes. But also, insulin makes us hungry. And the food we eat, much more likely to be stored as fat. Insulin is our fat storage hormone. So we can start to see how it's going to be a problem for diseases like obesity and metabolic issues like diabetes. But what if we trace this problem back to the beginning and we just didn't have so much glucose around that insulin needed to deal with? Let's take a look at how that could be. Everything you eat is either a carbohydrate, a protein, or a fat. And they all have a very different effect on glucose and therefore insulin levels, as you can see on the graph. So when we eat carbohydrates, our insulin and glucose are going to spike up fast. And with proteins, it looks a lot better. But take a look at what happens when we eat fat. Essentially nothing. A flat line. And this is going to wind up being very important. So now I want to translate that graph for you into a real-world situation. I want you to go back and think about the last time you ate an American version of Chinese food. We all know there's rules associated with this, right? And the first rule is you're going to overeat because the stop signal doesn't get sent until you are literally busting at the seams. Rule number two is in an hour, you're starving. Why? Well, because the rice in that meal caused glucose and insulin to skyrocket, which triggered hunger, fat storage, and cravings. So, if you're insulin resistant to begin with, and your insulin levels are already higher, you really are hungrier all the time. And we have this set up. Eat carbs, your glucose goes up, your insulin goes up, and you have hunger and fat storage. So, how do we recommend to these people to eat? Because it seems like that would be really important, and it is. Let's focus just on type 2 diabetes, because the general recommendations are to tell patients with type 2 diabetes to consume 40 to 65 grams of carbohydrates per meal, plus more at snacks. Trust me on this, that's a lot of carbs. And remember what's going to happen to glucose and insulin, blood sugar and insulin, when we eat them? Yes. We are essentially recommending that they eat exactly what's causing their problem. Sound crazy? It really, really is. Because at its root, diabetes is a state of carbohydrate toxicity. We can't get the blood sugar into the cells, and that causes a problem in the short term, but the long-term consequences are even greater. And insulin resistance is essentially a state of carbohydrate intolerance. So why, oh why, do we want to continue to recommend to people to eat them? The American Diabetes Association guidelines specifically state that there is inconclusive evidence to recommend a specific carbohydrate limit. But those guidelines go right on to say what we all know. Carbohydrate intake is the single biggest factor in blood sugar levels and therefore need for medication. These guidelines then go on to say, hey, look, if you're taking certain diabetic medications, you actually have to eat carbs. Otherwise, your blood sugar can go too low. Okay, so let's take a look at the vicious cycle that that advice just set up. So it's eat carbs, so you have to take medicine. Then you have to eat more carbs so you avoid the side effect of those medications. And around we go. Even worse is that nowhere in the ADA guidelines is the goal of reversing type 2 diabetes. This needs to be changed because type 2 diabetes can be reversed in many, if not most situations, especially if we start early. Not only do we need to let people know this, but we have to start giving them the practical advice so they can do this. Consider carbs. First, here's a shocker for you. We don't need them. Seriously, our minimum daily requirement for carbohydrates is zero. We have essential amino acids, those are proteins, essential fatty acids, but nope, no essential carb. A nutrient is essential if we have to have it to function, and we can't make it from something else. We make glucose, plenty of it, all the time. It's called gluconeogenesis. So, we don't need them. The overconsumption of them is making us very sick. Yet we are continuing to recommend to patients to consume close to, if not more, than half of their total energy intake every day from them. It doesn't make sense. Let's talk about what does. Cutting carbs a lot. Yes, in my clinic, we teach patients to eat with carbs as the minority of their intake, not the majority. So how does that work? Well, when our patients decrease their carbs, their glucose goes down, and they don't need as much insulin. So those insulin levels drop, and fast. And this is very important because a study looking at our National Health and Nutrition Examination survey data, better known as NHANES, showed that the single biggest risk factor for coronary artery disease is insulin resistance. It is responsible for a whopping 42% of heart attacks. Low-carb intervention works so fast that we can literally pull people off of hundreds of units of insulin in days to weeks. One of my favorite stories is a very recent one. A young gal, but who had an almost 20-year history of type 2 diabetes, came in when a physician from another clinic told her she was just sick and should probably get used to it. Her diabetes was way out of control. This despite the fact that she was on multiple medications, including almost 300 units of insulin that was being injected into her continuously every day via a pump. All of this, remember, blood sugar still out of control. So we put her on a low-carb diet, and now let's fast forward 4 months. She lost weight, yes, but better than that, sick no more. Her blood sugar levels were now normal all of the time. This on...
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Black Talk Radio.
You're back. We're back, folks. We're just about off the air. I want to say join me Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Chicago time, Chicago Standard Time, Monday through Friday on the George Wilder Jr. Show. And I will see you guys next week, Monday, starting Monday, 4 days a week on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Thanks for being with me. Thanks for listening. God bless.